Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that. And find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps, because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Yeah, Nolan, quit touching
what?
The dials, dude.
I'm turning my headphones down. You turned them up.
Yeah, you turned all of them up.
Okay. Nolan, yeah. Do you want to deliver the intro?
I think you should every time.
You're good.
Okay, yeah. Welcome back to Pass Gas.
Give it a little more.
Welcome back to Pass Gas.
If you're gonna do the intro, give it some.
All right, give us some
give
juice.
Give it some juice.
All right,
where's the juice?
Hey,
Bruce McLaren.
Yes, Nolan. It is. Hello. Hello, listener. Welcome back to Past Gas, the Donut Media Automotive History Podcast.
Yeah!
Thank you. Thank you for joining us once again. I love all the engagement we've gotten. I love all the kind words that you guys send us on Twitter and all the other places.
I want to apologize personally for all the gross mouth noises I've been doing.
Yeah.
So I want to clear the air. I'm not Deadpool's friend from the bar.
Yeah, TJ Miller is not in the studio with me today. Who is in the studio today is Mr. James Pumphrey.
Ooh, baby.
And Mr. Joe Weber.
You stole my noise, dude.
I'm sorry.
I was going to say, ooh, baby.
We were workshopping it in the car on the way over here. I didn't know that we decided who was going to get ooh.
It's baby. All right. You can have it.
I also just realized I'm still wearing sunglasses that I put on as a joke earlier.
No. We are discussing Bruce McLaren today, the life of Bruce McLaren. You know what? I don't know how many parts this is going to be today, or definitely at least two, maybe three, maybe four, depending on all the research.
Past Gas Podcast. It's about cars. It's not about parts.
Hey, guys. Welcome to the Past Gas Podcast. If you like Past Gas, please help us grow by giving us a good rating and a nice review on the podcast platform of your choice. It'll really help us out, and I really appreciate that. So thank you. All right. Now for the show.
The McLaren Automotive Company is known for building some of the coolest supercars on the road. There's a McLaren service station down the street from our office, and at least once a day, a McLaren 720S drives by, and I think, ooh, baby.
Yeah, ooh, baby.
That's the one with the sick, huge wing on it.
Or not the huge. I mean, I think some might have a huge wing, but that's the one with the big old hips.
Yeah, it looks like a spaceship.
Haunches.
Yeah, it looks like a spaceship. So yeah, McLaren, they're known for their supercars, as well as having a very rich Formula One heritage punctuated by names like Ayrton Senna.
Ever heard of him?
Lewis Hamilton.
Ever heard of him?
And my personal favorite, Fernando Alonso.
Ever freaking heard of him?
But how did the company get there, guys? What was it about McLaren Automotive's namesake that helped the company get to the top? Well, as we'll see, Bruce McLaren was an incredibly tenacious and brilliantly creative man. Two qualities, I think, drive the company today.
Those are great qualities. We just saw a little tiny kid being pushed in a toy McLaren.
Yeah.
This morning?
Yeah, this morning.
10 minutes ago.
Damn, dude. That's a sign. That's what you call an omen.
It was.
That kid's
a good omen.
That kid's dead. Is the devil in the form of a Rottweiler.
a Rottweiler.
So So, yes, our source for this episode is Bruce McLaren, From the Cockpit by Bruce McLaren. It was published in 1964.
Man, I have so much respect for someone who can write their own autobiography.
Oh, my God. And just the amount of detail that Bruce goes into on it seems like he writes about every race he ever competed in, and it's just like, it starts strong because he talks about his early life, mm-hmm. but then he just gets into this 100-page long stretch of just different races, and I was like, oh boy.
I always admire people who can do that and just like recall every little detail of like these crazy, like he must have done thousands of races, and the fact that he can go back and just like remember every turn of it is insane to me. That's like how Jay-Z like doesn't write his rhymes down.
Right.
What? Like, how do you do that?
No, he doesn't. Neither does Lil Wayne.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I don't even know your guys' names.
All right. So
without further ado.
Yes.
I'm excited.
Me too.
Let's dive in to the life and times of a Mr. Bruce McLaren.
New Zealand national hero. McLaren's autobiography starts with Bruce waking up in a German hospital. Oh, by the way, this is not a book report, but I just want to let you guys know.
Got you, man. We didn't think it was.
Okay. Anyway, he wakes up in a German hospital. He's wondering why he was there. Then he remembers chasing down John Surtees' Ferrari and Jim Clark's Green Lotus. He is oddly calm in his recollection. Quote,
"Most racing drivers have some sort of accident during their career, and deep in my heart, I knew there was no reason why I should be an exception. I thought this might be why I wasn't alarmed at finding myself in hospital."
This great quote from the opening pages kind of encapsulates the mentality of Bruce McLaren. If you don't fear crashing, then you're free to drive as fast as you want.
Hell yeah.
Bruce McLaren started racing as a, quote, he called himself a secretly scared 16-year-old behind the wheel of an Austin Ulster 7 in a hill climb. 10 years later, though, Bruce would be racing in Formula One.
"It is said that racing drivers are born, not made. But I guess I happen along those two categories."
Bruce McLaren was born on August 30th, 1937 in Auckland, New Zealand. Bruce's grandfather had started one of New Zealand's first, quote, bus and truck businesses. He didn't really elaborate on what that meant, but I just assumed hauling stuff and people. And Bruce's father ran a service station / garage in Remuera, New Zealand.
Remuera.
We are probably going to butcher some of these names.
Yeah.
Sorry
to all our Kiwis out there. We love
them. They're so cool.
Yeah, we do. I think we do have some listeners and definitely some people who watch our YouTube channel from New Zealand. We respect the F out of you guys. Sorry if I make your accent sound funny. That's not my intention. And sorry if we say a bunch of the words wrong. We're doing our best.
All right. Bruce had been around cars since a young age. Quote,
"Since then, there had always been a McLaren connected with motor transport."
Bruce's dad and uncles were adept motorcyclists who dominated the racing scene in New Zealand. If anyone in history was destined to be a racing legend, it seemed Bruce McLaren was hand-chosen by the gods of speed. But it wouldn't be that easy. When Bruce was almost 10 years old, he showed early signs of polio in his left hip. When the polio vaccine didn't ease the pain, the doctors decided to X-ray him. And they found early signs of Perthes disease, which affects lubrication in the hip and caused the joint to seize up. The doctors ordered Bruce to rest. Days of rest turned into weeks. Weeks turned into months. Months into years. Bruce's treatment would last almost 2 years.
And it's kind of crazy in the documentary because they just have to make his hips like as static as possible. So they put him in this like gurney kind of thing and strap his legs down so his hips can't move at all. Then they put weights on his ankles and he had to sit in this weird chair for 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah.
Bruce and four other boys were confined in similar setups and were given wheelchairs to get around. So they took that setup that Bruce was in, but then they made it mobile. It wasn't really like a wheelchair. It was just like you're just like in this weird.
It was like a gurney.
Gurney thing. Yeah. so when you have five boys in these weird wheelchair setups, it's inevitable that they decide to race them.
I mean, yeah, that's what you do.
Just push us towards the edge of the hill and we'll figure it out.
Bruce and his friends staged an after-dark wheelchair bed race around the hospital. One day, they chained their beds together and rode down some ramps in front of the facility.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Love these guys.
After gaining some speed on the ramps, the train of chairs went down the hospital's driveway where a right-hand turn was waiting for them. Since 10-year-old boys don't understand the nuances of wheelchair bed thing handling, the boy train collided with the curb and collided with the curb and caused a, quote, colossal pileup of wheelchairs. Bruce's traction frame broke free from the mobile setup and sent him flying into a flower bed.
Like, this is already a movie. Like,
yeah.
I can
see
Timothy Chalamet.
Bruce was in the hospital for 2 years before he was allowed to stand on his own.
Two years, dude, sitting in a bed.
Free from his standing wheelchair. However, when he stood up, he found out that one leg was shorter than the other. One of the hanging weights hadn't been set correctly, and Bruce would walk with a slight limp for the rest of his life. Dude, I'd be so pissed.
Yeah, that sucks.
You'd think they would like check in on it after a week and be like, oh, are all our weights set up right?
Yeah, they had 2 years.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with more of this story, but first, a word from our sponsors.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that. And find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps, because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angie.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
In 1949, Bruce left the hospital at 12 years old, and despite the limp and lost time spent in the hospital, one major positive was that he had a lot of time to study. As he explains it, his confinement meant he wasn't distracted by other things active 12-year-olds might have been distracted by, things like sports. As a result, Bruce was an excellent student, spending much of his time reading. Now, before Bruce left the hospital, his dad brought him a brochure for the new Jaguar XK120, the fastest production car in the world at the time. And Bruce spent a lot of his time looking through the brochure, something I can relate to, and I'm sure a lot of you guys out there can relate to. Now, he paid extra attention to the cutaway drawing of the 3.4-liter inline-six engine. And although he didn't really know what exactly he was looking at, the young boy started to feel that he could be a mechanic.
Bruce's parents enrolled him in an engineering course at Auckland College in 1951. He was just 14 years old. After the midterms, Bruce was second in his class, and he decided to pursue a career in civil engineering. A little later, racing in New Zealand really began to heat up. A local car club had set up a circuit at an abandoned airfield in Seagrove. Side note, we're going to talk about a lot of airfields that get turned into race courses. over the course of this, because that's kind of the thing.
Dan, dude, we got coronavirus going on right now. They're encouraging us not to travel. Maybe we should just take all the airports and turn them into racetracks.
That's a great idea. Dude, LAX would probably make a cool one.
No, Santa Monica Airport. Hopefully it shuts down.
Bruce's dad wanted to be in on the racing action, and for £110, he bought a dilapidated Austin Ulster 7, a sporty variant of the humble Austin 7. The 7 was kind of like Britain's Model T, but much smaller. The Ulster version had no doors and aluminum bodywork.
Nice.
It took Bruce and his dad, but mostly his dad, a year to put the car back together. Pops took the 7 out for a test drive and came back with white knuckles and a very shocked expression. The car could get going all right, but it had a lot of trouble with things like stopping and turning. Pops wanted to sell it, but Bruce begged him to keep the
car. Please, Daddy, let me keep the Austin 7.
Can we see my knuckles? Do you see my knuckles and my expression on my face?
Danny, it's just the brakes. I bet I could make a stop.
That's pretty much how it happened. Maybe Bruce could have the car, hmm? His dad agreed. Hey, son.
I can learn about brakes, Daddy. Maybe I could turn it into a job someday.
It's way more than a man can handle, so I'm going to give it to a boy.
His dad agreed and let his son keep the car as long as he took care of it. Since Bruce wasn't legally allowed to drive the car on public roads, he built a small race course in his backyard. This is where Bruce McLaren learned to drive. There's a story in the book about how he crashed the car into like his neighbor's garage doing this race course.
Then Bruce got his driver's license at 15 years old. Eager to get racing, Bruce found out there weren't really any events near him. But luckily, his dad knew of a quarry with a sweet 5/8 mile road leading down to the bottom. Luckily, his dad knew about that. If they could get a permit, this would make a pretty sick hill climb venue. More luckily, his daddy was a member of the Auckland Car Club and was able to secure the permits. Ooh. Sadly, but less luckily, his dad was sick the day of the event, so Bruce had to do it himself. The advice that his dad gave him was that if there was even a scratch on the 7, no more car from Bruce. It's like, yeah, son, you can take this and you can go race it in the quarry, but if you get even a scratch on it, you can't do it ever again.
I feel like that's impossible when you're just driving on little stones.
Yeah. He believed this warning gave him extra motivation to drive carefully as well as block the fear of his first event. He was too afraid of crashing to worry about where he'd place. Bruce fought his Austin 7 Ulster all the way up the hill, sliding around every corner, but the car made it across the finish line in one piece. To his amazement, Bruce had finished first in the 750cc class. Bruce McLaren had won his first race ever at only 15 years old.
That's insane. We need to find a quarry.
We need to get a quarry, dude.
Let's buy a quarry, build a hill climb course, have a freaking sick music festival in the bottom.
Take that, Cletus.
Yeah, we'll buy it. We bought a quarry.
And you can do your digging thing.
Dude, I can do my digging thing. Shh, shh, shh. I have a really good idea that involves digging a hole, but I don't want to say it on the air because I know one of you jerks will steal it.
Wait, I want to hear about it.
I'll tell you afterwards. It's a really good idea. It involves digging a big hole, but I think it can make us millions.
Okay.
According to Bruce, his 7 taught him much more besides car control, which it required a lot of.
Yeah, sounds like it.
But also the importance of, quote,
careful maintenance and preparation.
He goes on to say,
painstaking work in the garage before a race can mean the difference between winning and failing to finish. One of my first lessons was to tackle one job at a time. Do it thoroughly and be satisfied with the result before passing on to the next. This was Pop's doctrine, and it has always stood me in good stead.
Bruce and his father would modify the 7 for nearly every event, trying out something new every time. Pops would advise that Bruce would do the fabrication. In its 3 years of competition, the McLaren 7 Ulster never failed to finish an event or win its class.
Wow. That's big. Like, even in, like, a local racing thing, like, can you imagine a local SCCA, like, autocross club?
Yeah, like, stuff breaks. Like, stuff always goes wrong you don't think of, but this was, like, a rock-solid car.
Right, and then some days you're just having an off day, you're not really hitting it.
Yeah.
And can you imagine just, like, oh, that guy and his dad, they win the class every time, and they have for 3 years.
Yeah, it's crazy. After entering a circuit race at Oha Kia Airfield and finishing third overall and winning his class, Bruce sold the Ulster in 1955, feeling he had wrung out all the performance he could have. He was 18 years old. I just want to keep punctuating how young he is any chance I get, because, like, he's killing it.
Yeah. Do you think he wanted to go fast because he was in that wheelchair for so long? I feel like that was the point of the that was what they were trying to say in the documentary. They were like, he was a cripple as a kid. All he wanted to do was, like, get up and walk around and run with the other kids. Now he finally gets, like, mobility, and he's like,
and he just takes it as far as he can,
nuts.
Basically.
Yeah.
That's a good, I like that. I buy that.
I'm going to force that narrative in, so.
Yeah, please do.
But the McLarens couldn't stop buying race cars. Bruce's dad bought an Austin Healey 100-4, which they promptly started tearing apart. Mods included some Chrysler pistons, Buick cam and valves. It was port and polished. They port and polished the heads, a twin pipe exhaust, a full length under tray, which so,
is that aero?
Like flat bottom.
Wow.
Yeah, that's super cool. Yeah, in freaking, what is it? He's 18 plus 37.
55. He's born in 37?
Yeah. Okay.
So. I love, like, that took Joe a normal person amount of time to do, a very simple math equation, and Nolan and I are both like, whoa.
I'm really bad at math. I don't even know
your guys' names.
So, it has nothing to do with anything.
But yeah, a full-length flat tray on the bottom of the car in 1955.
That's really cool.
That's really super advanced. It had drilled brake drums and cooling ducts for reduced brake fade, which you need for extended driving sessions, and a fully revised suspension. The McLarens also won nearly every event they entered with this car. They're just freaking engineering geniuses.
Yeah, and it's just a hobby.
Yeah.
Just weeks before the 1956 New Zealand Grand Prix, which Bruce's dad intended to drive in, Pops' doctor told him that he had to sit out the race. Unfortunately, there wasn't enough time to find a replacement driver. So Bruce hinted, hey, maybe I could do it.
Pop. Hey, Pop, maybe, I was thinking maybe since he can't drive, doctor says no, I think we should listen to the doc. You know, he's got, you know, degrees, went to college for a long time for it.
Hey, Pop, look at this. Look at this.
Really care about your health and everything. I was thinking maybe I could drive maybe the car.
Look at me toes.
His dad was hesitant because Bruce would be going up against guys like Jack Brabham and the Stirling Moss.
Jack Brabham was one of Australia's best known drivers. He got his start on the dirt ovals of midget car racing, where he learned to perfect the on-power oversteer, or drift, as we know it. He would take this style with him to Europe, where he would regularly drive with, quote, full lock and lots of throttle.
This guy is my kind of dude.
No, Jack Brabham, as we'll see in the story, awesome dude.
Tight. Yeah.
Kind of takes young Bruce under his wing.
Dude, spoiler alert.
Oh. And young Bruce would go head-to-head with this guy. Bruce and the Healey were entered in a sports car race that ran before the Formula cars. Race.
Welcome back to Bruce and the Healey.
Bruce and the Healey. Hey. Bruce in the book mentions that the race organizers had they discovered the previous year that having two classes at the same time on the same track was kind of a bad idea, because you'd have these local sports car drivers that were like pretty good guys like Bruce, yeah, with like modded cars, but then you just have like Formula cars also just
It's like that would be like driving the Z's,
yeah,
you know, the high low cars,
yeah, against
because those are pretty good cars, pretty fast, like the best we can do, I think.
Totally.
I'd say you'd agree.
Totally.
With Lewis Hamilton and like Daniel Ricciardo like just passing us on each side, like,
I wouldn't mind it. I think we should do that. That'd be fun.
Yeah, let's just call up Mercedes. All right, yeah, stranger things have happened.
Yeah.
We'll get back to more Past Gas, but right now, a word from our sponsors.
Unfortunately, the Healey's head gasket blew a few laps into the race, but for a little bit, Bruce had proven that he could hang with the pros. He was racing with them. I mean, for short periods of time, because the Formula cars were obviously much faster. But in the turns, he was chilling.
Wait, he was keeping up with the Formula cars?
In the turns.
In the turns?
Yeah, because, like, they didn't have aero or anything to help them. they would just like, they'd be sliding all over the place. All the cars slid all over the place.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
McLaren would just brake later.
Yeah, they would just totally lose them in the straights, though.
After the weekend ended with the death of the Healey's engine, the McLarens took a break from racing
for about a month.
Not really a break.
It's not a break. As Bruce was focused on school, Jack Brabham's Cooper race car came on the market.
Yeah, the same car that
he had just raced.
Yeah.
Damn, that'd be crazy to just see, like, on Craigslist, someone's...
Lewis Hamilton's selling. Yeah. Like,
just trying to get rid of it. I know what I have.
No lowballers. No tire kickers.
As Bruce was taking this month-long break and focusing on school, Jack Brabham's Cooper race car came on the market. Now, this was a very serious car, one that could bring the McLarens to the next level in their racing career. They sold the Healey, Bruce's daily driver, and his bicycle to pay for the race car and entered the Hora Hora Hill Climb Championship race the very next day.
Yeah, he mentions the bike. It's like, all right, car, another car, and then a bike, which is probably would not... I don't think it'd go very far to help pay for a Formula 2 car.
Like a bicycle?
Yeah, a bicycle, yeah. Oh,
okay. That's funny.
I thought you meant a motorcycle.
No, it was a bicycle.
Bruce won the 1.5-liter class with ease. Now, Bruce and company had plans to campaign the car in America, hoping for a sponsor to get them to Sebring. Jack Brabham countered by offering to send them a 1.7-liter Cooper single-seater F1 car for Bruce to drive at New Zealand events.
Dude, you're like 19, mm-hmm. and this legend is like, hey, you want an F1 car?
It's like, yeah, I guess. I was thinking about going to America, but I guess I could stay in New Zealand.
I don't have any more bikes to give you.
Yeah, I'm all out of bikes.
Alongside that, there were rumors that the NZIGP, New Zealand's race sanctioning body, wanted to sponsor a Kiwi driver to race Formula 2 in Europe. And Bruce was apparently on the short list. To improve his chances of being picked, Bruce accepted Brabham's offer of the 1.7-liter Cooper. While he waited for the car to arrive, he finished his university exams.
The Cooper arrived to New Zealand when Bruce was 20 years old. He describes the first time sitting in the car.
I was entranced by my first view of the Cooper. I climbed in. The front wheels seemed close and gave me the feeling that it would be very stable. It had more instruments than the sports car, even a wood-trimmed steering wheel. Little did I realize how many hours I would later be spending in a Cooper cockpit.
Bruce's first time behind the wheel of the Cooper was out at Ardmore. He drove the 1.7-liter, while Jack Brabham drove a 1.96-liter Formula One car that had also been shipped over. The two racers took a few laps together, with Jack leading Bruce around the circuit, one of the best drivers in the world at the time, showing a young apprentice the ropes.
I had a marvelous time following his lines and hanging the tail out when teacher did. When we pulled into the pits, I was told off for hanging the tail out too far. A case, I thought, for the pot calling a kettle black. But I tried hard afterwards to motor in a neater fashion.
So that just means, like, swinging the back out more?
Yeah. Like, he's like, oh, dude, check out what I can do. Yeah. Teacher. Like,
what are you doing?
Teacher's just shaking his head.
Even though he's shaking his head while he is also just stone-faced doing
just
that.
Just smooth counter-steer. Yeah.
Jack and Bruce entered the 1958 New Zealand Grand Prix at Ardmore. Bruce's car broke down 8 laps in. Bruce thought his chances of getting that F2 scholarship were shot. I mean, why wouldn't they be? He didn't even finish the race. But at the post-race trophy presentation, it was revealed that Bruce had been chosen. Yay. His raw talent his raw talent behind the wheel made him New Zealand's best chance to get some podiums over in Europe.
When the time came to leave New Zealand, Bruce traveled with the Cooper by cargo ship, departing from Melbourne, Australia to Aden, Yemen.
Yeah, I had to like double check that because I was like, that's a really weird place.
Yeah, then he flew from Yemen to England after hanging out for a little while.
Yeah, in the book. Okay, he's like, he talks about time in Yemen and just about how he went to different people's houses for like 10 pages. Uh-huh. And I'm just like, why do I need to know this?
It's cultural, man. It was his first time outside of New Zealand and he goes to Yemen.
That's true. But I want to hear about race cars, James.
Hey, man, you need to widen your scope a little bit. There's a lot more out there than just race cars.
I suppose. Yeah, that's true. I learned that when I went to Pittsburgh. I was like, wow.
Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh was your eye-opening worldly experience.
Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh was Nolan's Yemen.
Pittsburgh was my Yemen.
Shortly after arriving in England, Jack Brabham drove Bruce to a small factory in Surbiton. It was the birthplace of Bruce's Cooper race car. Cooper. As Bruce and Jack approached the building's curved facade, complete with large glass windows, John Cooper himself came out the front door.
This seems like the opening of Jurassic Park.
Yeah. He was wearing brown overalls, his jet black hair slicked back, and a pipe hung out of his mouth.
Pleased to meet you, boy. Come in and have a look around.
Nah, he's probably like, pleased to meet you, boy. Come in and have a look around.
John Cooper was a titan. His Formula One cars had won 16 races and won back-to-back championships in 1959 and 1960. John would later lend his knowledge to the British Motor Corporation and help develop a revolutionary front-wheel drive town car for the masses.
Yeah.
They would call it, James.
The Mini Cooper.
That's right.
FWD for life, baby.
Bruce's first race in England was a bit of a letdown. He finished ninth in his Formula 2 race. And worse, a fuel sponsor he was promised back in New Zealand fell through when the company's London rep told him that he was one of the 100 racers that had come to England that year. Reality was starting to kick in for young Bruce.
Man, it's really hard out here. I'm going to go back to New Zealand and hang out with my dude.
I miss me dude.
Bruce was working in the Cooper factory, assembling a new-to-him race car to race. Once the new car was done, Bruce had a string of great outings at Britain's premier racetrack, Silverstone. The track began its life in 1943. It was an airbase for launching fighter planes and bombers during WW2. How it became a racetrack is something of an urban legend. In 1946, a local named Maurice Gogahan wanted to test out the top speed of his new car. The B roads around the town weren't long or straight enough. But then he remembered the airfield and its super long runways. Maurice went to Silverstone and found that he could drive right onto the base and did some laps down the runway and return road. He told his buddies about it. And in 47, 12 racers staged an illegal race at the airfield. Maurice ended up hitting a sheep during the event. So
Matt.
So that race is now known as the Mutton Grand Prix.
That's a good story.
That's a great story, dude.
It's amazing.
And that's just, you know, the kind of stuff you can come to expect from Donut Media and Pass Gas.
That's right. Bruce found his footing in the new car. So he had, like, he was at the Cooper factory. Mm-hmm. He was basically a team driver, but they're like, hey, like, if you want to race for us, you kind of have to build your own car.
It was a different time back then.
Yeah.
I mean, so many guys from, like, the 60s, like Ken Miles built cars, all these dudes, because who better to build the car? They didn't have all kinds of computers.
Yeah.
And like there weren't, nowadays you have a whole team of guys all over the world watching exactly what an F1 driver's car is doing, listening to his heartbeat, his pulse, which is the same as his heartbeat, but I'm sure they have like their blood pressure going and like all their vitals and stuff. But back then, like they didn't have any of that stuff. So the computer was the guy who drove it being like, hey, I think like the rear is kind of weird. And they're like, how weird? And then he's like, oh, you know what? It's just probably easier if I fix it. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. So like he was in the Cooper factory and just like going upstairs to find old parts and just putting that whole car together. But at the end, he had like a legit race car.
There's a funny part or something I noticed in the documentary was like, you know, nowadays you'd have someone like squirting water in your mouth from like a Gatorade bottle or something. There's all these shots of him like getting into the pits and then they just like give him a beer and drinking a beer real quick and then he gets out there.
Yeah, all these guys are like smoking cigarettes and drinking beer and stuff. Yeah, what a cool guy. Yeah. Just like, you know, people say it all the time, like they don't make him like they used to, and I really think it's impossible to make him like they used to. The world doesn't exist for guys like that anymore. I guess I honestly think the closest thing to racing in like this era, like the 60s now, is Formula Drift.
That's a good point.
Like, Dylan has been posting today. For the past few months, he's building his car for this season. Forsberg's car is all taken apart. Odie's car, he's building a car for this season. So I think like Formula Drift is the purest form of like old school motorsport.
It's still small enough that people like build their own and like sponsors are like don't have so much of a say in it.
Uh-huh.
They don't have a lot of sponsor money to begin with unless you're on a huge team.
And at this point, like I guess Vaughn is the closest thing with RTR to an actual team, but like other than that, there's really not like a Mercedes or like
There's no like team dominating.
There's no team. Teams that exist. Like there's no Williams in FD. Yeah.
Like it's still drifting still is very grassroots, even to its core. Like there's not like a grassroots Formula One anymore.
No.
Like you couldn't go to Mercedes and be like, hey, can I like can I build a car from your factory?
Yeah, can I like work in your thing?
You couldn't do that.
Work my way up to being a driver.
Drifting is like... I mean, that's what Dylan has done basically, you know? Like he's like, hey, Chris.
Yeah, he crewed for Chris.
Yeah.
Like he crewed for a driver for years.
And there's so many other stories. Like Aaron Parker.
Yeah.
Our boy. Yeah. Same deal. Like crews for Odie, builds his own car.
Love it.
Nasty.
I love I mean, that's essentially what you did, Nolan. You didn't start out doing what you're doing at Donut.
That's right.
Your way
I started,
up, dude.
James said, follow me. And then he said, okay, teacher.
And I said, hey boy, you're hanging it out a little too hard in those turns. And now you're...
Actually, he said that to you.
Bruce finished third in his first race at Silverstone, and he followed that up with a club race victory the next week. However, the other drivers at that club race were a little pissed that a, quote, factory driver and car had taken the W. Nevertheless, young Bruce is finding his confidence since his move to England. After a spin at Brands Hatch, a Cooper employee named Big Ginger Devlin told Bruce's mechanic, Colin Beanland, quote,
that mate of yours will either be a bloody good or he'll kill himself.
Little did he know that both statements were true.
Damn, dude, spoiler alert.
And that's where we'll pick up next week on Past Gas. Yeah, so that's where we'll head up next week. I hope that was informative. I'm looking forward to seeing where the... Actually, I already know where he goes, but I'm looking forward to where we go with Bruce McLaren.
Yeah, what a cool guy.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you for listening to Past Gas. If you don't already know, we also have a YouTube channel.
Yes.
We're called Donut Media, and if you like what we did here, we have a ton of shows coming out every week. Pretty soon, it'll be every single day of the week. All automotive content.
Donut every day.
Yeah, all informative and hopefully all funny. Follow Donut across social media at Donut Media to get behind the scenes looks and everything we got going on, as well as sneak peeks of upcoming stuff. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at James Pumphrey for the same reason. Follow Nolan at Nolan J. Sykes for the same reason. Follow Joe at Dark_Webinar for the same reason. I love you.
Be kind. See you next time. Joe, do you want to have a sign off, Joe?
What about like just
you
a
can't
wink?
Do a wink. It's an audio format.
Winky wink. Bye.
Winky wink.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.